Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jane McCafferty, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the writer Claire Beams. Claire Beams is author of a story collection called We Show What We Have Learned that was published by Lookout Books in October. This was a book that got a lot of attention. It won the Kirkus Best Debut of 2016, and it was a finalist for the Penn Robert Bingham Prize. It was longlisted for the Story Prize. It is a finalist for the Young Lions Award at the New York Public Library and got great critical acclaim, including Joyce Carol Oates calling it a dazzling story collection. As if by a rare sort of magic, Alice Munro and Shirley Jackson had conspired together to imagine a female feminist voice for the 21st century that is wickedly sharp-eyed, wholly unpredictable, and wholly engaging. Claire lives in Pittsburgh and teaches at Carnegie Mellon. She has two young children, and her stories have been widely published in such journals as the Kenyon Review, Hayden's Fairy Review, and Best American Non-Required Reading. So welcome, Claire.
Thank you so much for having me.
Would you like to give us a nice reading from one of your stories?
Sure. I'm just going to read the start of the title story.
Great.
We Show What We Have Learned. Before her disintegration, we had long held an absolute and unwavering contempt for Miss Swenson. She had won that with her uncertainty, which we had sensed in the very first moments of our very first day of fifth grade, the way dogs can smell fear. Waves of it rolled off her, along with the odor of cats and Kleenex and chalk that hung unsurprisingly in her sad, pilly sweaters. Miss Swenson was pitiful, but this did not mean we pitied her. We felt nothing for the faded blue of her eyes, which were like a sea creature's soft underbelly, or for the way she kept them open so wide and blinked so rapidly that she seemed to be seeing us through a mist. Her movements, too, were misty, whereas we were sharp and quick and feral. We did not wonder much about her life. She seemed ageless to us in the way that most adults seemed ageless. We could not have said whether she was 25 or 40, but we did know that she was younger than most of the other teachers. This was less because her face was unlined than because she seemed so much more unfinished. Everything Miss Swenson ever said to us had a question in it. Even when she explained long division or poetry, things it was clear she understood and loved, and even when she told Mark Peters to stop it when he pulled down Sally Winter's pants and underpants to show us the hair-flecked space between her legs. The question in her voice then was simply more panicked than usual. The day the disintegration began, we were learning about Native American civilization. We were always learning about Native American civilization. We began each year with it, and then we might, as on that day, when we were supposed to be talking about the Civil War, make several unexpected detours back to revel in the quietude of that life so close to nature. The teachers all loved these lost things, vanished ways of life, great men who died early, extinct animals, and Miss Swenson loved them even more than most. We watched while she drew a wigwam on the board. Miss Swenson was very bad at drawing, worse even than the worst of us, because she was crippled by second-guessing. She darted in to draw a line, darted back to look at it, darted back in to erase it and start over. "Is that straight?" she asked us. "But wasn't it supposed to be rounded? Wasn't that the whole point?" Finally, she sighed in a way that meant she was giving up and settling for the misshapen thing she had produced. "You see, children, the hole was put there," she said, pointing, "so that the cooking smells could escape. It's ingenious." Her hands began to wave desperately and hopelessly, as if she were trying to breathe with them, like vestigial gills. There was something beautiful about her excitement in these moments, irresistible target though it was. The early colonists were never so ingenious. In many ways, the civilization they would brutally overpower was vastly superior to their own. Abner Harris raised his hand. Miss Swenson never did learn not to call on him. Perhaps she was distracted by the glimmering vision of wigwams in her mind, a whole village of them where she might have lived gently and happily in our absence, tending plants, fetching water from the stream, watching smoke rise toward bright stars. "Yes, Abner," Miss Swenson said. "Is that what holes are always there for?" "Is what they're always there for, Abner?" "So smells can escape? Is that what, like, Rachel's hole is there for?" "Rachel's hole," Miss Swenson said musingly, still failing to understand, though Rachel was already blushing. When Miss Swenson got there, two red spots appeared high on her cheeks. "Abner, that is inappropriate," she said, and yet managed to sound as if she were asking for permission to reprimand him. "What is?" Mock innocence was mortally wounding to her. She couldn't help taking it at face value. We waited, snuffling into our hands and tasting the salt of our palms, chewing on the skin around our fingernails with the glee of what was coming. To speak about the, she flopped like a speared fish, private parts of others. But Miss Swenson, said Billy Nichols, drawn to the blood in the water, which parts are private? I forget. We squeaked our sweaty hands against our desks in joy. Now she would have to say them, say those words. What could be more wonderful? We would hear them from her lips. And that was when it happened. We would, ever after, wonder what caused it, the force of the bottled-up, forbidden words we were calling forth, or the hammering blows of the humiliation we were delivering, whether the force came from within or without. Miss Swenson, in her agitation, flicked her webby hair behind her ear, chalk still in hand, and in the process flicked some object off herself. It flew forth with so much force that the act would have seemed intentional but for the puzzlement on her face. An earring, we assumed at first, but the earrings Miss Swenson wore were not as large as this. Hannah Perkins, in the first row, began to scream. She was peering over the edge of her desk at the thing on the floor, and she curled her feet up under her as if to keep them away from a mouse. We left our seats and clustered around the space in front of Hannah's desk. The thing on the ground was an earlobe.
Amazing.
Thank you.
I love the way that you draw that moment out where we don't know what she's knocked off of herself. It seems really one of your signatures is that ability to draw out a moment and to create suspense.
Oh, thank you.
We can talk about that with regard to a couple of other stories. So poor Miss Swenson.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she, it's a good way to talk about the kind of writing you're doing right now with mm-hmm. this story, I think. Yeah. So maybe you could just say what else happens in the story so we can mm-hmm. set the ground for the kind of fantasy that you're...
Sure. So Miss Swenson proceeds to fall apart.
Literally.
Literally fall apart, sort of increment by increment over the course of the next little while in the story, while this sort of tribe of fifth graders watches. And then at the end of the story, it turns out we sort of reach the culmination of her disintegration where her head has fallen off. So it's clear that we're kind of reaching an end for Miss Swenson. and it becomes clear that what she's been doing is sort of teaching them a lesson and that she expects them to have been learning to come apart too. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of mm-hmm. where the story ends.
Yeah. It's quite a wild story,
yeah.
as are many of them in here. So I thought maybe you could talk about your path as a writer, how you were working on a novel, and that then you turned kind of away from that novel toward this more, I guess, magical realism, or I really don't know how to even describe what you're doing because it's a real mixture of things. Sometimes you're mm-hmm. in a very realistic,
right.
literary, straight mode, and other times you're playing a little bit with genre, I mean, with mm-hmm. fantasy, with horror, with
right.
you know, all kinds of things that make these stories really unique.
Oh, thank you.
So maybe you could talk about, like, how it was writing that novel, why you turned from it, who mm-hmm. maybe who you were reading at the time, or what just, you know, how did this happen?
Because
it's really quite a turn for you. Yeah,
yeah, it was. So yeah, I mean, I do, I still enjoy writing realism as well, although it's not quite like the realism that I was writing before I sort of took this turn. So yeah, the story that I just read from, the title story of this collection, is the earliest story in the book and did represent just a real departure from anything else that I had ever written. And so basically my path was, I had majored in English and creative writing in undergrad, and knew that I wanted to write, and so applied to get an MFA and went straight out of undergrad, even though a lot of people had sort of told me that that's not always a great idea. And I think it really can be for some people. But I think in my case, I did really know that I wanted to write, but I didn't actually really know what I wanted to write yet. I knew that I loved language. I knew that I loved reading stories. I did not have sort of a natural grasp for constructing a story of my own. And I don't even know quite how this happened, but I sort of had decided that I was like a very sort of quiet, realistic writer. And so that's what I was writing all through my grad school program, were these sort of very tense, quiet stories where like there's a conflict, but you're not really sure what it is because nobody actually ever says anything about the conflict. They just like, it's clear they are, things are not good, but nobody's going to talk about why. There's just going to be like in the distance, a dog barking, or, you know, like it's just, so I wrote this, a lot of work in that vein that just wasn't very alive. And I think that part of it was that I was trying to sort of learn the rules for writing a story, mm-hmm. And kind of be a good student and write a good story in the way that I had mm-hmm. observed that good stories were constructed. You know, I think it was a very afraid way to be writing.
But you were learning form, would you say? You were
learning
what has to happen in a story?
Yeah. Or? I mean, I think I was reading really carefully all mm-hmm. through this time. And I think I was starting to think critically. I was getting good just from workshop at thinking critically about stories in general. But I think that I was applying all of that in a way that made me afraid of taking risks in my own work. And I mm-hmm. think that that had to do with being as young as I was. Mm-hmm. I think that I, you know, I'd always been a pretty good student and I just like wanted to get this right. And I don't think that's really the way that you write a really good story usually. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that good stories generally for like a large portion of their journey toward being are like teetering right on the edge of toppling into something that doesn't work at all, mm-hmm. you know, often.
Certainly these stories, I think,
certainly
in this
these
collection,
are,
you know, but
right,
you pull them
right.
off, but wow, you go,
thank you.
You take us to a verge.
Yeah, well, and I think that just for me, and maybe that's because the life that I ended up finding in writing again was very connected to risk for me. So I think that what happened, so I wrote this novel that was this kind of quiet, realistic novel. And I graduated from my program and I went to live in Massachusetts and was teaching high school English and was revising that novel, which I would continue to do for like another 5 years after I had finished with the draft that I graduated with. Mm-hmm. But sort of in the process, so after my third year of teaching, I had not really written anything else new in all that time. And I was feeling pretty distant from workshop in a way that I think for me was sort of a liberating feeling. And I think, again, that's no slight on my workshop. I mean, my workshops were great. I just think that I was too, I think I was not well positioned to learn as much as I should have from them, or I think I took away the wrong things. I was trying to, my version of an ideal workshop experience at that point would have been like, nobody said I did something wrong. You know what I mean? Like I was still approaching it the way you would approach like the writing of a really good English paper in college, you know? Mm-hmm. So for me, like feeling very distant from all of that, I think freed me up to this was just a crazy idea that I had sort of maybe a week after classes had ended that third year of teaching, as I was falling asleep in that like strange liminal space while you're not yet really dreaming, but you're also not totally, you're not like a totally sane and rational person anymore. Yeah. You know, you're kind of drifting. And I just had this sort of vision of this teacher falling apart. And then like, what would that teach her students if they were still learning from her while she was doing that? Like what kind of a lesson is that, you know? And I even had sort of like a vision of how the last line of the story might go, which almost never happens to me anymore. At the point where I was in grad school, I was trying to plan everything out, like even down to the last line. Yeah. So that again is part of like, I just wanted to control the whole thing in a way that I don't think is really the way it works, as it turns out.
But with
out.
That particular story,
with
you,
that
you
particular
got the
story,
you knew how it was going
to
end.
I did. I didn't know much else. And I sort of like part of the fun of it was to try not to, like just to sort of see how I would arrive at that end moment.
You must have been really surprised because
I was really surprised. And I also, when I woke up in the morning and looked at it with my sane brain, I had jotted down like sort of as much as I knew in that strange, crazy, you know, in between state. And when I woke up, I thought that it probably was just like not really even worth my time to try. But then I also had this really liberating sense of like, well, why not? I mean, if I try it and it's terrible, nobody has to see it. And it sounded like a lot of fun to me to write it all of a sudden. And I don't think that I had really had fun writing for some time. And so I think that for me, and I had been reading, I think heading into that story, I had discovered maybe like the year or year and a half before that, like a bunch of writers like Kelly Link and Amy Bender, and I had read some stuff like that in grad school, but not really those particular writers. So I think I was sort of, I think all of that had sort of seeped in, and I had sort of closed a lot of doors for myself as a writer, I think, prematurely. And so I just decided to sort of try it. And I think after that writing experience, not all of the stories that followed that story that I wrote after that story were as strange, but I think I tried to keep that feeling of like playing.
Yeah.
As I was at least writing the first draft, you know.
Nice. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jane McCafferty, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the writer Claire Beams, reading from We Show What We Have Learned. You want to read a little from another story?
Sure. Let's see. I'll read maybe the start of a story called Ailments. All my life, Frances had been hard to bear, but marriage had turned her intolerable. Our mother had taught us about love, speaking the word as if it named an illness and tipping her faded aristocrat's face toward our father as he chewed or scratched his chin. Our jowly, thick-fingered father, dust from the road to London worn deep into his knuckle creases. Understanding as I did the roots of my sister's affliction, though, made me no more inclined to forgive her for it. I should have been glad that we had gotten Frances married. It had been no sure thing. The match made our father hearty and exultant. I could tell that our mother, who knew more, felt not joy so much as the floating up relief that comes when a burden is removed from one's arms, an urge to reach toward the sky from which had come this great reprieve. Robert Cresswell was not a man well known to any of us. He had been a physician in London before arriving in our village and had accounted for himself only by saying that he wanted a change of pace, and then that he wanted Frances. I had thought they would set out for somewhere after the marriage. It was evident from the first that he was a man in need of a stage, but they seemed instead to be rooting themselves in place, just a few houses down from our own. This left Frances free to come and sit and sew with me daily in the same room where we had sewed together for years and interminable years. Robert reads, you know, Frances told me one afternoon a few months after the marriage. He reads all the time. He reads aloud better than anyone I have ever heard. I could have struck her with the book on the table beside me for all the hours I had read aloud to her in that room. Though our mother had taught us both to read when we were small, somehow Frances, elder of the two of us, had taken to it more slowly and never fully. When she wanted reading, the duty of providing it had thus fallen over and over again to me. The book, a volume of Petrarch, had a good heft. It would have thumped a nice red knot onto that doughy forehead. Robert knows so many people, Frances said. They send him letters from all over in all sorts of languages, people he knows from his travels. They want his advice about medicine. They want his ideas. She raised her eyes from her sewing and widened them at me, muddy ponds reflecting nothing. She looked like a startled cow. Impressive, I told her. Watch your work, though. That dress will thank you for it, and so will your fingers. Always the wit, she said, with maternal indulgence, as if she had not lived in mortal fear of that wit for most of her life. Then she seemed to forget me again and sighed the sigh of a woman with a mouthful of her favorite pudding. He's just so brilliant, Cassie. I listened as I had to. For the rest of my life, I would be listening to Frances. I would like to speak to the soul who could have blamed me for what I felt. And were there certain features of Dr. Cresswell himself that contributed to my unrest? Would I have preferred that his hat sweep a bit less boldly across his forehead, that his eyes tend more toward dimness, that he sit his horse just slightly less well, that the lines of his legs cut into me not quite so sharply, that they not rise like welts on the surface of my mind as I readied myself for sleep? Yes, yes, oh yes, that was a part of it too.
Thanks. So in that story and in the story called The Drop,
mm-hmm.
I felt that you'd created a kind of heart-pounding suspense at the
Thank
end.
You.
And I wondered, how did you learn how to do that as a writer? I think it's pretty rare to see in a short story. So I wondered if you had...
Interesting. Well, so I think that maybe it's something that I have to learn for each new story, you know, because I think that the way each story builds suspense is always different. And you never quite know what how you're going to need to do it until you start doing it and what you're doing isn't working, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that in both of those stories, I probably learned how to put the suspense in there by kind of arriving at just absolutely the wrong ending several times and then kind of like backing up to figure out like, well, is the ending itself wrong or is everything leading up to the ending wrong, mm-hmm. which is usually where I find myself. I think often if short story endings do not work, you're in this funny position where that's usually a bigger problem than just a problem with the ending.
Yes.
Because of the way they function sort of architecturally in a story, I think
yes.
you need, usually if the ending falls flat, it's because there's some whole other scaffolding that you haven't built yet.
That's right. Or if you can't find the ending, the same thing.
Same thing, applies. Right? You know, is something actually happening in this story yet? Right, you know, if you don't know where to end it, that's telling you something important about the story. And it's almost always where I find myself at the end of a first draft is with an ending where I'm like, well, that's not it. You know, so I'm gonna have to go and try again. And I think that in the course of doing that, just like the endless rereadings and tearings of it up with a pen, and you know, that you sort of the pace begins to sort itself out. Mm-hmm. And that for me is very key to making the whole thing work, I think. And you only know it starts to work very gradually through like many tiny changes of.
I'll bet when it does start to work, you feel the tension very acutely.
Right.
Like in those endings where you're really taking us into a kind of bizarre space.
Right. And I often end up in this place where I know that I want to be in the bizarre place, but I know that it doesn't work getting us there yet, you know, so I have to back up and like sort of lay the breadcrumbs you know?
Yeah. So a lot of your stories have feminist themes, and I wondered if you could talk about whether or not you approach the stories thematically ever, or if the themes kind of emerge out of stories that end up surprising you, or, you know, how conscious are you that, or were you, that the collection
had these sort of unifying things in it? So I think for a very long time, I was not conscious at all. I think while I'm sort of actively like embroiled in the writing of something, I'm really trying not to think like sort of big picture that way, just because I find that it's so daunting that I just like, it's hard enough just to sort of like move your character through the spaces you want them to move through that if you're also thinking like, and I must be a faithful feminist, like it's just hard to sort of do that. You know, I think that when I started to put the collection together, I did become aware of certain sort of echoes and interesting sort of parallels between things and sort of started to play with them and sort of draw them out. And I became conscious of that before the writing of some of the stories in here too. So I had
like
the idea.
Like which ones?
So some of the later stories are like the Renaissance Person Tournament, Grana, All the Keys to All the Doors. Grana and Renaissance Person Tournament I wrote early drafts of like while I was pregnant with my first daughter.
Okay.
And then I wrote All the Keys to All the Doors for this book. So that one was probably the most conscious in that way in terms of like I have this set of stories that I am saying or a book. So this needs to fit with them, you know. But even then I tried to put that out of my head for a while just because it's hard enough to kind of make the one individual like sort of like questions
story
like
work,
pacing
right.
or
yeah.
what I'm thinking about most of the time.
Yeah.
So
the story Grana, could you talk about that a little bit and maybe how you got the inspiration?
Yeah.
Maybe even read a couple like just a couple paragraphs.
Yeah, I'll read you the start of Grana. Okay. Grana. In the wake of the end of things with Adam, a good and generous man, Teresa felt the need to do something self-evidently good and generous. Adam had made her feel incapable of giving. She would show him giving. She called her older sister Deb and said, "Let's take Grana up north." Grana? But there were tried, true ways to force Deb to override her better judgment. Teresa blew a gentle puff of air into the phone. "I just think," she said, "that it's the right thing." When they pulled up to the retirement home where they had stashed Grana 5 years earlier, she was there on the bench out front, hands crossed in the lap of her high-waisted silken dress, waiting for them, looking very, very old. "Where do you even get dresses like that anymore?" Deb had said once, years ago. Until Deb mentioned them, Teresa would never have thought to wonder about the dresses, any more than she would have wondered about Grana's own particular skin. "Yikes," said Deb's daughter Ellie from the back seat as Grana rose, squinted at the car, and began to come slowly toward it, shuffling in her Band-Aid-colored shoes. Ellie was 9 now. Teresa hadn't seen her since Christmas. During the car ride, she had displayed a new knack for saying aloud the very thought that had been in Teresa's head, too, but that she never would have voiced, so that being with Ellie was like being stripped naked before herself.
And then that story's really about transformation.
Right.
About Grana
I think a
becoming.
Lot of them are sort of at the root of it. But yeah, so that one, I was writing that story. I think I had the idea for that story. Well, there's often like several things for me that kind of like converge to make a story. And usually the first seed of something is an image for me. And so my parents have a place up, like way, way, way up in Vermont, like right across the border from Canada. And it, in one of those places where it's beautiful and it's on a lake, but you feel it's really the middle of nowhere. Yeah. Like in the winter, you feel like if you died there, no one would find you until spring.
Wow.
You know?
And did you go there as a child?
So they didn't have that place until I was maybe a junior in college, I think. Mm-hmm. So no, but we had been to sort of similar kind of like camp-like feeling places in Michigan when I was a kid. So that experience of like, you know, deep, dark forests, mm-hmm. And then kind of many, like much space between houses was always sort of like a interesting space for me. Mm-hmm. And then I was, so their place is on a lake. And I saw this little, like, I still don't know what it was, like some sort of like mink-like thing kind of like slunk out from the trees. And it was clearly a mammal, but it had this very snake-like way of moving. And it just, the image of that was just very interesting to me. And those mm-hmm. creatures, whatever they are, surface near the end of the story. Mm-hmm. And then I did have, growing up, my great-grandmother was still alive until I was 13. And so she turned 100 right before she died. And it was very much this feeling of some of the images of Grandma herself I borrowed from my own great-grandmother in terms of, like, dresses where you just really felt like you were looking at, like, somebody from another era. Like, yeah. Just sort of habits that she had carried forward with her mm-hmm. in this way that made
where
her—
Where was she from?
She was from Pittsburgh, actually.
Really?
She was born here. She worked in a glove factory here. And then my grandmother grew up here. But by the time I came along, I think everybody had moved away— by the time, so I had never been here like in conscious memory before we moved back. I grew up in Connecticut and then we lived in Boston in my sort of earlier adulthood. But I do have this like family past here. But so mm-hmm. she, some of the images of like the dresses are things that I mm-hmm. borrowed from her. Mm-hmm.
It's great where you take her so that she becomes this powerful, mm-hmm. strong
yeah.
swimmer who's
right,
getting,
right. younger.
Getting younger.
right,
yeah.
right. And I think that the other thing that I was playing with in that story is I was writing this right around the time that like sort of all of our couple friends were beginning all at once to have children, mm. you know, and just sort of it was interesting to me the way that sort of we move through our life in this. You feel like you're making all these highly individual choices and yet like you're making them sort of like as a pack. And I started to think about sort of what it would be like if you were part of that pack as Teresa was when she was part of her couple and then kind of like fell off and yeah. weren't really sure why.
Yeah.
And then so sort of, I wanted to kind of put a lot of those elements together and just sort of see what happened. So.
Great story.
Thank you.
So maybe read just a couple lines from any story that you, sure. you want to, because we're running out of time,
okay.
unfortunately.
Let's see. I think I'll read just maybe the very start of a story called World's End.
Sure.
By the time the World's End job came to him, the architect was 26, but no longer considered himself young, if he ever had. He felt his professional life had begun. He shaped land, not buildings. He was a builder of landscapes, one of the first of his kind in New York, though this was the 1880s and Olmsted had already carved out Central Park, strange hole in time and space, in the middle of the skyward straining city. These were the days when wealthy people were just coming to realize what their commerce had paved and grimed over, and to miss that green in the pure religious way they missed the childhood of their earliest memories. The architect had a knack for making the lost thing feel less lost, for sculpting expansiveness into a city courtyard.
The writing of Claire Beams. Claire, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody. 90.5 WESA.